Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Welcome to this week's episode of Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name's Kirk Chisholm, and I will be your host today. So today we have Brent Henningsen. How are you doing today, Brett?
I'm doing well.
Good. Well, this is an exciting show for all you listeners. This is another one of our Tax Loopholes of the Rich episodes. These are episodes where we try to bring you some really cool and interesting stuff from the deep, dark bowels of the tax and financial industry, where really only the very, very wealthy 1% are able to take advantage of some of these, which is not necessarily the case all the time. But this is the type of people that typically invest in these strategies, and we are bringing them to you so that you can do the same. So we're talking with Brent Henningsen, who is the CEO of Saber Pension and Actuarial Services. Brent is a CPA, and he primarily works with defined benefit plans. So how's it going, Brent?
It's going great, Kirk. I'm actually TPA, which is a common misconception, but a third-party administrator. Works, like you said, on defined benefit plans.
That's not the first time I've made that mistake, and I'm sure other people are wondering the difference. But what's the difference between a CPA and a TPA?
So CPA, you know, somebody who obviously specializes in taxes. A TPA is a third-party administrator, and they generally help with employee benefit plans, like health plans, 401k plans, and in my case, defined benefit plans. You know, they do the compliance, the administrative pieces of those plans to ensure that the employer is dotting all their I's and crossing all their T's.
So you're a third-party administrator. So you primarily just focus on defined benefit plans? Is that all you do?
Yeah, I exclusively focus on defined benefit plans. In some cases, if an employer has employees, they'll couple the defined benefit with a 401k plan. If that's the case, I'll do sort of the umbrella work, making sure that the two plans interact and coordinate.
So if you're only doing defined benefit plans, maybe you could, excuse the pun, define a defined benefit plan for us.
Absolutely. So, and I'll talk about it, I guess, in the context of 401k, because I think everyone's familiar with those type of plans. So, you know, when you have a 401k, that's the type of defined contribution plan. And the way that works is people put in money every year. And when they get to retirement age, what they actually have is a pot of money. It's going to depend on how much money they've put in and what the market's done. With a defined benefit plan, it's actually the other way around, where you define the pot of money essentially up front. So if somebody's 40, you would define a target up front. And then every year you would have an actuary with somebody like me who would calculate what contribution would be needed to attain that final goal.
So effectively, if I said, hey, I want to have $10 million in my defined benefit plan, I could just define that and then contribute it?
Essentially, yeah. I mean, the limits right now is $2.9 million payable at 62, but it's pretty common for somebody to define that maximum and then work towards that goal.
This is pretty cool. I kind of want to talk about the differences between the 401k and the defined benefit. So the defined benefit, just for clarity, that's what, a pension, right?
Yeah, that's another name for it.
Okay, because I know that if you look back in the, historically speaking, pensions were a big part of retirement. And when did that change? Like, what caused some of those changes? Maybe you can kind of talk about that, because I think people have heard of pensions, but a lot of people don't have them anymore.
So pensions started at the end of the 1800s. We became more industrialized to reward employees. And they went kind of ramped up in the 40s and 50s. Because of some abuse with employers, there was a lot of legislation around protecting employees regards to pensions. And so some of that started to unravel pensions in a way. In other words, kind of unraveled the demand for employers to want to put them in. But then there were other things that happened. I mean, we had the market crashes in 2000, 2008. That required employers to put in an enormous amount of money all at once. We had accounting standards that made it a little more onerous to record and more expensive from the corporate profitability standpoint. And all these factors created this gradual shift from defined benefit to 401k plans, because they're just a lot easier for employers to have.
So if you kind of look at this now, the larger employers, from what I can tell, are pretty much doing away with defined benefit plans. I know some of them are even trying to, was it FedEx was the one that just stopped, I think the other day, just said we're no longer contributing to it. So do you see it? Let's go back to the step and let's talk about the differences between a defined benefit and the 401k. What are some of the major differences between the two plans?
I'd say there's kind of three major differences. The first one is, and kind of talking about it, especially in the context of the small business, because that's where I specialize. So with 401k, if they have a profit sharing component, somebody can put in, you know, around $60,000 a year. It's a good chunk of change. And for most people, that's plenty of money to contribute. But you have this small percentage of the population where that's not enough, where they would like to contribute more. And that's where a defined benefit plan can be a really great alternative, because the limits for a defined benefit can be $100,000 to $250,000 plus per year. And so it's just an enormous opportunity to make a tax deductible contribution. So that's kind of the first difference. The second difference really is with a 401k or SEP or profit sharing. Every year, the employer can decide whether they want to make a contribution or not. And so there's a lot of flexibility with that discretion. And for a small business owner, that can be obviously an important thing, because profits can vary from year to year. With a defined benefit plan, it's a little bit different. When you put in a defined benefit plan, every year, at least in most years, you're going to be required to put in something. It's not going to be necessarily a fixed amount. There's going to be a range of possibilities or contribution range that you can contribute. But it is more of a commitment in a sense that you're not going to say in a given year, yeah, I don't feel like contributing, so I'm not going to. And then just kind of that third difference is with a 401k, usually the accounts are individual accounts. And so each participant's account is tracked in its own account. Whereas with the defined benefit, the assets are pooled and then the benefits are kept track of by somebody like me, a TPA.
So basically, if you had like 100 people, they'd all have the same account and it'd all be pooled together.
That's right.
Okay. So it sounds like the defined benefit plan is a good strategy for small business owners or people who are earning a good income. What are some typical industries where this plan might make sense?
I would say it's a pretty broad section of industry. I mean, the traditional users of defined benefit plans are the doctors, the dentists, and the attorneys. And so there's definitely a demand in those industries, mainly because they tend to be obviously higher income, smaller businesses without too many employees. It just makes sense for somebody like that. When I started this business, one thing that actually surprised me is just the number of people who are non-traditional users of defined benefit plans, where there's a lot of interest. And what I mean by that is those in the, what I'll call the digital space. So people who are doing things like, you know, YouTube stars or food blogs, or maybe they're doing Facebook ads or any kind of digital marketing. I have quite a few clients in that space, and they tend to be younger than what the traditional user is. You know, a lot of them are in their 30s or early 40s. And sort of the thought there is, even though they can't contribute as much as they would be able to if they waited until they are 55 or 60, they know they're in an industry where the profits are good now, the industry that changes quite a bit, and it can change pretty quickly. And so the thought is, if they're doing really well now, if they're making 500 or a million right now, why not put in $100,000 or $200,000 today and continue doing that for 5 to 10 years and kind of take advantage of that tax savings?
That's great. I know we have a lot of people from the health service sector listening to the show. So I've seen certainly a lot of interest over time to do that. But in regards to a plan like this, is it similar to like a 401k where you can just invest it in anything? Or what's some limitations, or how should people look at that part of it?
There's a lot of flexibility in what kind of investments someone can contribute or sort of invest the contributions into. Obviously, any marketable security like stocks, bonds, ETFs, mutual funds, those are all fine. There's alternatives like real estate, you know, more exotic things, maybe like art. Some of the limitations around those alternatives, though, is if somebody has employees, they need to make sure that they're investing those assets in a way that they're being a fiduciary and they're doing it in the best interest of the participants. So, for example, if somebody had invested in a beach house in San Diego or something like that, and then as the owner of the company and the trustee of those assets was using that property for family vacations, that wouldn't be acceptable. That'd be because it wouldn't be in the best interest of the plan participants.
All right. So the owner of the company can't go buy a sailboat and sail around the world and the employee pension. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, exactly. Or buy some kind of art and then that art's hanging on their wall at home and displayed to everybody. It's just, it has to be in the best interest of the plan participants.
What if they invite the plan participants over for like holidays and they get to look at the art? Does that count?
That'd be nice, but yeah, probably not.
So I don't know if you have some examples that you've gone through, obviously no names, but just how this works and maybe some ways that people have been able to save a good amount of money.
One that comes to mind is a person who had a large payout, $5 or $6 million. And they knew it was sort of a one-time payment, and then there would be subsequent income earned, but it would be quite a bit less than that large amount. And this person was in their 60s, early 60s. Their spouse worked in the business, which is another kind of bonus because you can essentially double how much you can deduct. And so for this particular person, we were able to say, okay, based on your income, your spouse's income, based on your age that you're close to retirement, and then based on the fact that you want to front load contributions, so sort of put more in the beginning with the idea of putting less in as you go, they're actually able to put in about $900,000 into their defined benefit plan between that and the 401k. So, I mean, that was an example of kind of a home run where they needed a big deduction. There was no other retirement vehicle that could get them this size of deduction, but a defined benefit plan provided that solution.
Wow. I thought it was much lower. So basically there's no number limit per year. It's really just dependent upon how old they are and information like that, correct?
Yeah. And that would be kind of an extreme example. I mean, it would be harder to get a contribution much larger than that. I mean, it's all within the regulations and guidelines, but that would be, like I say, a home run where they're close to retirement, their spouse is employed and really want to front load that contribution stream.
You know, not everybody is a one-person business. Some people might have small businesses. You mentioned dentists, doctors, attorneys, you know, maybe architects, people like that. There are people who make good money, but maybe have some employees. So what are some rules of thumb people can think about as they're considering this type of thing for their business?
When you have employees, you're required to cover them or at least a portion of them under non-discrimination regulations. And what those rules are for is making sure that if the owner is going to get a tax deduction, that they're not just taking all the contributions and funneling to themselves as the owner. So they're giving their employees something in exchange for that tax deduction. So if they had employees, kind of a general rule of thumb is 8 to 10% of their staff payroll would be sort of a rule of thumb around what it would cost them. As an example, if let's say they had $1 million in payroll, it would cost them $80,000 to $100,000 in benefits. If they were able, between them and their spouse, who could also be an employee, to save $250,000 or $300,000 in taxes, maybe that's not such a big deal. So it's kind of weighing the value of that tax deduction against the cost of providing those staff benefits.
It sounds like as a staff member, it'd be nice to have this sort of plan. Are there ways that the employers can... Do they have to offer this to everybody, or are there certain caveats and carve-outs they can have so that it doesn't have to be offered to every single employee?
So if they're not an employee, let's say they're an independent contractor, then they wouldn't have to provide a benefit to them. And, you know, obviously they need to be a bona fide independent contractor to be excluded. If somebody's under 21, then they also can be excluded. And then if they're part-time, meaning they work fewer than 1,000 hours a year, then they also could be excluded. But I mean, there's also a carve out if someone's part of a union collectively bargained agreement. So, I mean, there are opportunities for carve outs, but for those who don't fall in those categories, they generally are going to need to cover those or at least a portion of those people.
So you mentioned spouse too. So how does that work? Can you get twice the benefit if a spouse works in the business?
If it's sort of owner and spouse, then definitely. If there's employees involved, then sometimes the spouse can be used a strategy, I guess, to reduce those staff contributions. And what I mean by that is by giving the spouse a smaller benefit, it just helps pass the non-discrimination testing. So it's kind of trying to get to the employer's objective of how much they can save, and at the same time, trying to minimize that overall cost. as they need to provide something to their employees. And so it's kind of balancing a lot of different factors to get to that result.
In terms of the defined benefit plan, so when can people take funds from that?
So when you establish a plan, there's rules around what's called permanency. It sounds a lot more scary than that sounds. They don't have to be in existence forever. But what the IRS is trying to avoid is somebody putting in a plan, taking a huge tax deduction, and then immediately terminating that plan a year later. They're trying to avoid, obviously, someone creating some kind of a tax gimmick. And so generally, if someone keeps the plan 3 to 5 years, from the IRS's perspective, that's going to satisfy the permanency rule. Once that plan is established, funded, and then after that 3 to 5 year period, it can be terminated, then those funds can be rolled over into an IRA or to some other qualified plan like a 401k if it allows rollovers. And then it would then be subject to that plan receiving those funds. So it would be subject to like the IRA rules, for example, with the 59.5.
This sounds great. If I wanted to set up a defined benefit plan, what would I have to do? Do I just go down to my local broker dealer and just set one up? How does this work?
Defined benefit plans are a real specialized. It's a lot different than setting up, let's say, a solo K or a SEP. Those things can obviously be done by the business owner on their own a lot of times. With the defined benefit plan, it requires that you have an enrolled actuary certify the figures. And I'm an enrolled actuary. So they would need to contact somebody who specializes in defined benefit plans. Typically, the first step is just kind of talking about what they're trying to achieve. How much are they trying to get into the plan? Do they have employees? How long is their horizon? And then from there, it's putting together an illustration to show them what that would look like in hard numbers. And then if it makes sense, then it's obviously going through the steps to adopt and fund the plan.
I've spent half my career working in the broker-dealer world. I'll tell you that there's not a lot of talk about defined benefit plans. It's not the thing that they teach you over there. There's nothing wrong with that. They're trying to help, but I find that most advisors aren't even familiar with this. They don't know how it works. They don't know how to do it. It just seems like it's really complex. There's a lot of things actually we talk about on the show that you probably never have heard of. And part of the reason is the fact that a lot of advisors just don't know. They've heard of pensions, they've heard of defined benefit, cash balance plan, they've heard of all these things, but they're not really familiar for many different reasons. So I would suggest for everyone to, if your advisor is not familiar with this, look around and talk to other TPAs like Brent that can probably help you with this, because I know I've learned a ton from working with Brent with plans that we do, and he's extremely knowledgeable in the fact that this is the only type of business that he does. You're an actuary. What does that take, a week to get that?
I started working on these type of plans in 2001 and I got my actuarial credentials in 2008. So, I mean, for me, it took 7 years. You know, that's kind of on the fast end of the spectrum for somebody to be what's called a fellow of the Society of Actuaries. It's obviously a lot of work, a big commitment, and there's a lot of work that goes into understanding how these plans operate.
I say that in jest because I know how hard it is to be an actuary and how to pass that test. I've had a few people like try to explain it to me and I'm just like, why would people ever want to go through that? That just sounds painful. So Brent, this has been awesome. I'm glad to have you on the show. I'm glad we're able to share your knowledge with a lot of people here as listeners, because I know this is one of those tax loopholes of the rich that I really want to kind of get the word out there about. You know, we've had a few people on the past talk about some other ones, and we'll have some others on the future. But for people really, you know, high income earners that are looking to put money away for retirement, this is a really interesting vehicle to explore as a way to exceed the 401k limits that most of us have with our annual contributions. Any final thoughts or things we haven't talked about, Brent, you think we should know?
I think you hit it right on the head a second ago, is when does it make sense to explore this type of plan? And just to kind of keep it real simple, I would say if you're being limited by your current retirement plan in the sense of how much you can put in. So if you want to put in more than the $60,000 that a SEP or 401k allows, if your compensation is such that there's a compensation limit that's coming into play, if you're being limited for any reason on those type of plans, that's where it's at least worth asking the question if this plan makes sense for you.
Great. Well, Brent, I really appreciate you coming on the show here and sharing your knowledge with our listeners. And where can people find more about you?
So they can go to my website, which is saberpension.com. And that's S-A-B as in boy, E-R, pension.com. It has a pension calculator where people can try to figure out you know, how much they could contribute per year. There's case studies. So there's a lot of good information on there.
Thanks for coming on the show. We'll certainly put a lot of this information in the show notes so people can learn more about this really interesting topic. Thanks again for coming on the show, Brent.
Thanks, Kirk. Appreciate you having me.
Have you ever heard a radio ad and thought, wow, what a great idea. I really want to give all my money to a random stranger that I heard on the radio. Hey, you can't say that. Why not? People do it every day.
Sure they do. But why are you pointing it out?
Well, because some people never learn that lesson of not talking to strangers. This is a public service announcement. If you hear a radio ad that promises you 100% of return of gains with little or no risk, if you hear an ad that promises you easy money, or if it sounds too good to be true, well, it probably is. Do your own research or hire a professional. Either way, your money is way too important to your future to make hasty decisions. If you're experienced enough to do your own research, please spend the time. If you're not that experienced to do your own research, hire a professional. Someone experienced in providing investment due diligence, someone who is unbiased, and someone who's going to put your interest above their own. But if you don't know one of those people, you're in luck. Some of them are on this show as hosts and guests. Check us out each week to learn how to invest and protect your wealth. Oh, and remember to sign up for our new free report, The Top 10 Investing Myths That You Know to Be True But Aren't. This report is going to blow your mind. Go to moneytreepodcast.com/myths. Once again, that's www.moneytreepodcast.com/myths. Thanks again for listening, and remember to invest in your life.
Wow, that was a great interview with Brent Henningsen. I'm really glad we had him on the show because I know Brent's a real expert in this area, and I'm always leaning on him for his expertise when I come across this in my practice. Now's the time to move into the panel portion of the show. So this week we have another two great panelists, especially both of them are experts in this area. One is our regular Megan Gorman. How's it going, Megan?
Hi, Kirk. I'm good. Getting ready for the holidays. How about you?
Me too. I'm getting ready. I'm not sure if I am ready, but I'm getting ready.
I don't think any of us ever are really truly ready.
Just do our best.
Exactly.
And we also have a returning panelist, Kelly Coughlin.
Hey, Kirk, how you doing? And sorry to break the news, but I am ready for Thanksgiving. So there.
Yeah, well, for all the listeners, we're approaching Thanksgiving now, so I'm sure everyone's already had their fill of turkey. But this is going to be a good show because I think this is a topic that very few people understand. You know, we try to bring you topics like this. One of the segments is called Tax Loopholes for the Rich. And I think this is one of those topics that most of the people out there, 90% plus of the people, are not familiar with because it probably doesn't apply to them in most ways. But it's something that I think people should be aware of because the more it's talked about, the more ideas you can come up with to maybe save on taxes or stock money away for retirement or any other type of planning you're doing. I guess let's start it off. So Megan, you heard Brent's talk. What are your thoughts on defined benefit plans? I know you use this a little bit in your practice, but how do you look at defined benefit plans?
First of all, I'm a big fan of defined benefit plans. And I think that because this segment is coming up as tax loopholes of the wealthy, I think that the first thing to preface it is I often find when there's a tax loophole, the reason that high earners or wealthy individuals can take advantage of it is they actually have the liquidity to do so. And that's often the hurdle for most Americans face. I think the thing is these are really important plans in the context of the American discussion on retirement. And what most Americans are not good at doing is being proactive in their retirement planning. So just to give some context, Northwestern Mutual just came out with a study this year. They're planning a progress study and found 15% of Americans have no retirement savings at all. And that those who do have retirement savings are underfunding it. So when you start to look at the world of retirement planning, you know, to really maximize and to really get your financial picture to where you have to get it to, it requires engagement of an individual to seek out what plans are available to them. And what I find is that for individuals, and in particular, I have a lot of clients who are consultants or, you know, solo practitioners who are attorneys or doctors with practices, is that when you start to go down that path, there's some obvious candidates for choices from IRAs to SEP IRAs. but that for those who have practices that are lucrative and they don't need the cash flow to live off of, a defined benefit plan can be a really interesting option. And I say interesting because when you go down the path of a defined benefit plan, as you know, we heard on the show, you're making a very big commitment. This is different from a SEP where you can make a decision on an annual basis if you want to fund it. This is a type of plan that you have to go and get put into place. And let me tell you, the process is a long process. In fact, for plans to fund for 2019, you had to have decided, I think, by October 31st of this year. So anyone who's considering this, you can't do it for 2019 anymore. You really are looking at 2020. But when you set up these plans, you have to get calculations done by a TPA on how much you have to fund and how you're going to be funding year after year based on your income. And so for a lot of individuals, that's the hurdle to get around. But this is where I think for many Americans who are eligible for these plans, they really have to think about their future self. And the idea of setting up a defined benefit plan that by the time they're 65 could have seven figures in it, it's a really powerful tool. And I'm going to stop right here because I know Kelly, who's on the panel with us today, he does these all the time. And I'm curious to hear his perspective.
Well, I agree with everything you just said, Megan, because I'm a big fan for certain types of enterprises. We can go into that later of what the profile is. But I'm a huge fan of a certain type of enterprise, the companies that you kind of describe generally, setting up C corporations and setting up defined benefit plans within that C corporation and loading it up with fringe benefits for the key principles in there. And I look at the defined benefit plan as just one of the many fringe benefits that can be integrated into a company and the key principles of the company. So I'm a huge fan of it as well, because you can really load up your retirement assets much better than certainly IRAs and the kind of the plain vanilla stuff. They're expensive to do. At least they're more expensive than just going down to your credit union and, you know, writing a check for $5,000 in an IRA, that kind of thing. But in the long run, they're terrific for a certain type of enterprise.
Kelly, you and I both do taxes in our practices. And I think that the one thing I find is the people who are able to maximize this are the ones who are engaged in a proactive tax planning relationship, which sounds like an odd thing to talk about. But one of the things that I find with most Americans out there is they're not engaged with their tax planning. In fact, they don't even value tax preparation. But for those who have these businesses that could do a defined benefit plan, I find that the people who are most successful with it are the ones that are constantly engaged in their tax planning. This isn't something that they just come up with one night and they decide to do it. I'm assuming, Kirk and Kelly, you guys find the same with your clients. The ones who do it are actively engaged in their planning.
I agree with that, but I'm going to put some of that responsibility or that, I don't know if it's a failure, weakness on the provider side, people like us. I don't think enough of us get involved that way. There's, I don't know, 300,000 tax preparers out there, that kind of thing. And 95% of them simply tick the boxes. Kirk, I think you started out with for the rich. I don't know that this is all just about tax planning for the rich. I don't think you have to be Jeff Bezos or Amazon or Donald Trump to take advantage of this stuff. I think it doesn't have to be the top 1%, but the top 10, 15, 20%, they could benefit from this stuff, and they should. And I think providers are the ones that need to step up and kind of lead the way.
I think you're right, Kelly. And I pose this as tax loopholes for the rich, because one of the segments that we like to talk about are a lot of the strategies that wealthy people use to shelter taxes or defer taxes or tax-free in some cases. But the point is educate our listeners on strategies that people use so they can start thinking proactively, as you're saying, about their own situations. Maybe they can educate their own advisors, their tax or financial advisors, because quite frankly, I mean, Megan, you could probably attest to this. Most financial advisors aren't even aware of this. They don't understand defined benefit plans. It's too complicated for most of them. Many of them aren't even allowed to provide it because their firms don't allow it. And from a tax perspective, from a tax preparer, Kelly, I mean, you know, you're a CPA. As you said, most accountants or tax preparers, they're checking the boxes. They're not proactive. And it's not that they don't want to be. It's just that they're too busy. They've got hundreds and hundreds of clients that are screaming for tax returns and they don't have time to be proactive. So, you know, I really feel for them. But at the same point, that's what individual investors are relying on, or advisors and accountants, to be able to provide these sort of strategies. It's very important that the listeners understand the strategies so they can bring it back to their advisors and say, hey, why didn't you tell me about this? And how can we take advantage of this for this year?
Well, and Kirk, I think one of the hardest things, I'm going through this right now with what I'm setting up for a pediatrician, is the rules are very complicated and very sensitive. When you set up this plan, depending on employees that you have to also fund this for your employees. So when you're going through the process to set up this plan, besides having to get tax returns for the business, your personal returns, you know, you also have to be looking at the W-2s and the hours worked by all your employees. It's time consuming to do this. There's a lot of administration in setting this up. And TPAs, to their credit, are careful. They're very, very careful. And when you're in a state like I am in California, where it's a community property state, there's even more complexity because in community property states, we have to look at what the spouse's business is and if the spouse has employees and can they be attributed to the person who's trying to set up the defined benefit plan. So I think the thing is, and I agree with Kelly completely, practitioners need to get more proactive in getting their clients to do this. But it's also when they do it, it's setting the expectation that this is going to be an arduous process of getting a lot of details, because ultimately what you're paying for, and Kelly mentioned the expenses, general, I think the cost of these plans are roughly between $2,500 and $5,000 a year. What you're paying for is an actuary to get involved to do the calculations. And the actuary has to make sure that they're working within the IRS code so that this plan actually is a defined benefit plan. I'll be curious with both of you, setting the client expectation on this, it's hard because it's a complex process.
I agree with that. It is complex and you do need an actuary. And that's why these actuaries take their 15 exams to get prepared to do this stuff. But let me ask you guys, in terms of the complexity and the, Megan, I think you said long and arduous task. I think that kind of depends on the profile of the company. So I'm going to posit this, that the low-hanging fruit that I look at, that I target for defined benefit plans, and both of you weigh in if you disagree with this. In my mind, these are the no-brainers that they should absolutely do this. I'm working on one in Minnesota now and then one in Chicago. And here's the common denominator. The one in Chicago has only one employee. Now, let's just talk about him in Chicago. He makes about $290,000, $300,000 on his professional consulting business. Is there any reason on planet Earth, he's 52 years old, he's got a wife that makes plenty of money also, any reason that you guys could come up with why this guy isn't the perfect profile for a defined benefit plan?
Provided he has the liquidity, it's a slam dunk, right?
Slam dunk. Yeah. He can fund virtually $220,000 if he wants to, correct? In his defined benefit plan.
Correct.
Now, the trick is he has a commitment. If he gets volatility in earnings, right? If he makes $50,000 next year, then he gets in a bit of a jam. Is that your understanding of that?
Yeah. There's some flexibility that he can do less one year, more another year, but it has to balance out. Yeah.
It has to balance out. But if he's the only employee and he's nobody else that he has to also contribute to, it's a slam dunk. So that's what I look at as the low-hanging fruit. And I don't think those kind are as arduous as, well, if you got 50 employees, that becomes a problem. So what I think is the sweet spot for defined benefit plans are, A, you've got a key principal that is over the age of 50. Do you guys agree with that?
Yes. Yeah, although I'm doing one right now with someone who's 42. We've got so much excess income and we don't know how long she'll want to work, to be honest.
But in terms of the sweet spot, you might get some aberrations, but if you're over 50 and you have free cash flow, I mean, true free cash flow, meaning you don't need it, it's not encumbered with anything, and you don't have a bunch of employees, like less than five employees, isn't that the sweet spot?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is important because when you talk about these kind of plans, I mean, most people don't understand and it's complex. And I think it's good to talk about some of these scenarios because a lot of the listeners are thinking, well, I don't know if this applies to me. If you're a one-person company or just a handful of people, then it certainly works. But Kelly, you were talking about some other scenarios. I think it's important to kind of talk about some other scenarios that can work for people and what really makes sense.
I mean, other fact patterns in a business profile?
Yeah.
They have to have the free cash flow. I think that applies to everybody. I tend to think it's more in the service business. And maybe that's because in a lot of the manufacturing businesses or distribution business, you're dealing with lower profit margins. And so the free cash flow isn't always there. But if you're dealing with a service business, you know, white collar service business, it could be real estate, it could be insurance, it could be some sort of consulting, architecture, you know, doctor, you know, lawyer, that kind of stuff. Those tend to have the free cash flow and they tend to have the fewer employees, tend to, compared to a manufacturing company. I think that's the scenario. I'm talking to a painter in a commercial painting company that in Minnesota that they make quite a bit of money between the two partners. So what I've done is put together a sample 1040 from their S Corp and show it flowing through and what is taxes there and what would happen if we set up a C Corp and fund the defined benefit that way. And, you know, then I can kind of quantify with tax software how much they actually save from this thing.
That's great. I think it's, we've started to see a lot more people who are interested in doing this type of savings plan. Cause I think part of it is people are making a lot more money and the economy is good. So we're starting to see a lot more successful businesses and, you know, with good cash flow. So what about you, Megan? What are some examples that you've seen? Obviously we're not saying people's names, but.
A lot of my client profiles, you know, I work with a lot of corporate executives who eventually go into consulting after they leave the corporate day-to-day world. So typically I see people, I find it's a slam dunk for anyone who, you know, they're a solo practitioner. It's very easy to set them up on it. And when you run the numbers out for a lot of them, it makes sense. But I think in general, this is a type of plan that more Americans should be doing and can be doing and just trying to get the liquidity to fund it. Because I think that is the hardest part in this. And this is why working closely with your CPA is key, because you've got to have the liquidity in the business. So anytime I've set this up, granted, I work in the high net worth space, but it's usually in a fact pattern where we have enough income coming from other sources that we're not going to miss the income coming in to fund this. And they can make the type of commitments that are possible. The other thing is, it's always about setting client expectations the right way. I'm a big believer in simplicity is often the best route. So in examining going down this path, I do like to look at other options with the client to make sure that this option makes the most sense. Because again, once you commit to it, you're married. You're not dating, you're married in this. And you have to make sure that you're doing it correctly every year.
As we kind of go through this and dig through some of the details. And, you know, we're trying to keep it a little bit high level because really we can dig into the weeds and probably put people to sleep. But as we kind of go through this, it's really important to understand all the different parts of this because it is a fantastic vehicle for the right type of person, the right fact pattern, as Megan says, and just having, you know, the right profile. It's not the best thing for everybody. If you have one really good year and the rest of the years you're not going to have, it may not be the best thing. But if you're looking to put away extra money each year and you don't need it and you want to put it away for retirement, then it can be a really good vehicle to increase what you're trying to put away over your 401k amount. You know, there's a lot of details that go into this, but I would say if you're making more than you need, if you want to put more away for retirement than you actually can, and it's your business, then it's definitely something to consider. And there's some other options too that hopefully we'll touch on later in other episodes of the show too, of tax loopholes of the rich, if you will. But in the interest of time here, Megan, any final thoughts on this that people should take away from this?
Look, I think the ultimate takeaway is we have seen over the past 30 to 40 years, the onus of planning for your retirement shift from companies to the individual. And so for all of us, we need to be doing retirement plan. There's not one American who shouldn't have a retirement plan. We all need one. But for those of us who are solo practitioners or we have small businesses, we need to get proactively engaged with our planning. And for the tax professionals who are working with them, they also need to get engaged with the planning to take advantage of really unique opportunities like a defined benefit plan. But to go with what Kelly said, you know, when these things work, it's a slam dunk. And in a lot of instances, you can really mitigate your taxes and really accelerate your retirement planning. And that's what it's all about. And I think for clients that have done this, they feel pretty good about going down this path. In fact, I find that most of them feel that it was a very clever decision. But if you're thinking about it and you're hearing this and you're like, this sounds like an interesting idea, get started on it now for 2020. It's too late for 2019, but 2020, you can do it.
Awesome. And where can people find more about you, Megan?
Sure. You can find me at thewealthintersection.com or Megan at thewealthintersection.com is my email, and on Twitter at Wealth Intersect.
Thanks for coming on the show this week, Megan.
Thanks for having me. And it was nice actually meeting Kelly on the show this week. It's the first time we've been on the panel together.
Thank you, Megan.
Yeah. And Kelly, what about you? Final thoughts from you.
I'm going to echo what Megan's saying about the general concept of retirement plan. But since this was on defined benefit, I'll just add a couple things to that. Defined benefit plans used to be the bread and butter of retirement work, you know, like after World War II, when all these companies started hiring and Fortune 500 companies, and everybody had defined benefit plans. And there's only a handful of people still alive that are beneficiaries of these wonderful, juicy retirement plans. I see them in my business. You know, they might work for the railroad. They might work for a number of these bigger companies. But because they were so lucrative for the employees and so costly for the employers, they got rid of them. But today, it's an opportunity where you can set these terrific plans up for your own benefit. Now you're the employer and the employee. So there's kind of a zero sum there in terms of good for one, bad for the other. But it's really a home run. The product structure, I think, became the unwanted stepchild. I think we can say that. It's not a politically incorrect term, is it?
Everything is today, Kelly.
I didn't say red-haired stepchild. That would be incorrect, right? But after defined contribution plans, everybody, the sexy 401ks, you know, they became the dominant product structure for these things. And defined benefit plans, strangely enough, got thrown in the back burner. But they need to be reevaluated and considered for certain types of businesses because they are far and away superior for certain types of companies, superior to the defined contribution plans out there.
Great. And where can people find more about you, Kelly?
Well, I'm at Kelly at everydaycpa.com.
Awesome.
Everyday, everydaycpa.com.
Thanks for coming on this week, Kelly. So that's it for the show. I would also reiterate Kelly's point. A lot of these older companies, some of these bigger Fortune 500 companies still have them. Some of the aerospace military contractors have them. Some of the telephone companies have them. These plans are great if you were part of them long ago. But there is a concept which we'll probably touch on the show at a later date, which is the public pension crisis, which is a different kind of pension. And that's a whole nother topic, but also one that's interesting to talk about. So that's it for this week for the show. My name is Kirk Chisholm. I'm a wealth manager at Innovative Advisory Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find more about me at innovativewealth.com. And of course, you can find me every week here on the show. So that's our show for this week. Thank you for joining us on Money Tree Investing Podcast. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Play. You can also check out our show at moneytreepodcast.com. On our website, you'll have access to all the resources, show notes, and the archive shows. Lastly, please leave a show rating and comments on the podcast app of your choice. When you do this, it allows us to get better guests and it shows that all of you guys are contributing to the podcast. And that's what a lot of guests want to see is that we have an interactive listener base. Have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.